Dola Lobis Pacem means, of course, let there be peace. And I want to start our sermon today about hunger by thanking some very special people who do a lot to extend the peace in the hearts and homes of a lot of people here in our community. And those are our volunteers that work here at our food pantry at Brew. First of all, I've got to ask Liz Alcasius and Marilyn Truxall-Hamburg to stand. I see you out there. These are two very humble ladies who give a lot to our congregation and to our community. And let's give them just a... Marilyn and Liz consistently go far above and beyond the call of duty to make sure that we're able to serve our community to the best of our ability. And recently, in no small part to the tireless efforts of Liz, we received as a congregation a grant from the Capital Area Food Bank for $2,000 because she showed up to the meeting early. She got an extra $75. And if you consider, I was supposed to do the math on this, but I was told there was no math in ministry, and so I didn't. But if you consider that they get a great deal of our food from the Capital Area Food Bank for 12 cents a pound, $2,075 is a tremendous amount of food that they have made possible for people in our community. I know that they would not be content unless I thanked their team of volunteers and the folks who make this thing happen and keep it alive. That team includes, but is not at all limited to, Mary Kadlebowski, who staffs the pantry on a regular basis, Tila Cox, our administrative assistant, who I am convinced is only a miracle or two from sainthood, Paul Burkholz, whose company, the Visiting Angels, makes regular donations, the Monday Night Spirituality Study Group, who has made a commitment to the food pantry a huge part of their spiritual journey, Ed Davis and Elaine Phillips, who are also regular volunteers, and Marge Landis, who brought a great big pile of pumpkins around Halloween. And there was one story about a little boy who came in to get food with his family, and he was so overwhelmed by the joyfulness of picking a pumpkin, he couldn't even say any words. He just, like, pointed. They make a difference, and we are so grateful for everything that they offer. Thank you. One summer, when I was working as a hospital chaplain, I was called to the bedside of this woman who'd been fighting cancer for some years, and she was getting close to the end of what had been a pretty brave battle. She wasn't exactly young, but she'd always been, I thought, perky. She'd always been the sort of person who told the nurses not to make a fuss over her, and when she called me on that day to come and visit her, she wasn't as perky as usual, and it wasn't because of all the usual reasons you might expect. It wasn't because she knew she was dying, though she did. It was because she had something very serious she had to tell me. In a way, she said she had to make a confession, and I know we're not all into the theology of confession, but what she really wanted to do was tell her story, and she wasn't going to rest until she got it out. Because it was a story that had been sitting on her soul for decades, and sometimes the telling and the hearing is all there really is to confession anyway. Sometimes folks just need to get a story out, and all we can do is listen to it. And her story was this. As a young girl, I think in Poland during the Second World War, this young woman had been stranded with members of her family in their rural home somewhere far away from cities and bread lines and formal emergency assistance. The fields were all burned and their food was taken or destroyed by waves of advancing or retreating soldiers from one side or another. And there was nothing to eat. And so one time, and one time only, that she would never forget, when she was a little girl and she was hungry, this woman had stolen. And she had to confess. In her case, it was actually scraps of food, something like potato peelings, from a dog's bowl. She stole that food and she ate it, And while she may have had one small and meager meal, her real hunger, the hunger to be taken care of, to be safe and full of dignity, that real hunger went unabated for something like 40 years. And decades later, in her suburban American hospital room, safe amidst middle-class comforts, she wanted to confess, "I was, you might imagine, incredulous about such a confession. After all, these were nothing more or less than real circumstances of life. She did what she had to do. She did what she must, and not God or I or anybody with half a brain in their head would judge her half as harshly as she judged herself." But I tried not to dismiss her as she spoke in these tones of confession, and I tried not to let my full belly and my middle-class security blind me to the full meaning of her confession. With more listening, I came to understand a little bit better why she had to tell that story. Because to her, that story wasn't really just her story. The awful circumstances in which she was forced to live, the indignity she had to suffer at the hands of an unjust world, her guilt, I learned, wasn't just guilt over stealing food. It was a tragic sense of guilt that even as she spoke, all those decades later, some other child somewhere was doing the same exact thing. Sure, her hunger at the time, in that moment, as a small child with nowhere to go for weeks and months at a time, her hunger was for food. Her little belly must have gnawed at her, and her need must have been stronger than most of us can imagine. But her hunger in the end, as she faced those last days, is a hunger I think we can very well relate to, even if we have never ourselves starved. It was a hunger for dignity, for honor, for respect, and for the ability to live in this world as a person who does everything in their power to be worthy of their own high expectations. Her hunger was for a world in which little kids wouldn't have to steal food anymore, and in which no war or regime or tragedy of indifference would drive her or anyone else to such a place of shame. She knew that she was dying and that the world she wanted wasn't real yet. And it made her feel more in need of confession than any little stolen scrap of food ever could. Sure, the circumstances of this story are dramatic. I always make catty comments about how the one sure way to make sure your sermon is a cliche is to use a story about the Nazis. But those circumstances, as distant as they might be, as dramatic as they might be, that story and those circumstances is not so far as we think from the suburban home in which we make our lives. Her hunger took place amid the backdrop of the most devastating war in modern history, and the forces that acted to push her into hunger and desperation were none other than those forces of Nazi Germany. But she knew, lying there in a hospital bed in Illinois, close to the end, that history isn't so far away after all, and that even the most dramatic tales we can tell of the past are just a prelude to the very real, very immediate suffering of right now. This is, of course, the season of abundance, and this is the time of year when donations flood to food pantries across this nation, mostly of various Thanksgiving staples like cans of gravy. It is also the season wherein donations drop off the most sharply as soon as the long, bitter cold of January and February make their appearance. This season, entrenched as we are in the midst of economic downturns and a slowdown in the local, federal, and international economies, Nazi Germany may well be the rapidly receding past, but hunger here is a very present reality. In preparation for this, I have been clipping articles from the Washington Post. I've been building this little pile of woes on my kitchen counter for the last few weeks. And what I've learned, according to the Post, is that the Capital Area Food Bank, where we receive our food for our food pantry, feeds 383,000 people in this region each year. Among those 383,000 are, of course, many who come here to our food pantry. Marilyn and Liz interface with the Capital Area Food Bank to provide what we have to offer. But food from the Capital Area Food Bank is getting harder to come by, and resources across the region directly assisting those in need are being stretched to the limit. At Capital Area Food Bank, cash donations have fallen 10% since last fall, and food contributions are down 15%. Meanwhile, this is amazing. Call from needy residents to the food bank's Hunger Lifeline have jumped 248% in the last 6 months. Bread for the City, another D.C.-based group, is also seeing a 10% increase from last year, and a soup kitchen that feeds a great many people in the city so others might eat is serving 820 meals a day, up 100 just since last fall. Here at Brew, September brought such a sharp jump in requests for food that we made the necessary choice of limiting our food bank disbursements to twice a month. But Marilyn and Liz's efforts have connected us to this great program that enables the working poor, folks who have food stamps, to come once a month for distribution of USDA food that doesn't cost us a dime. Capital Area Food Bank feels like it's drowning. There are times when we feel like we're drowning. Global partners like Oxfam and the United Nations feel like they are, at best, treading water. According to one recent study by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, 923 million people worldwide are seriously undernourished, and 35 million of them are right here. And in one final shocking testament to how great the need really is, at least 12.5% of the population of the District of Columbia can be categorized as food insecure, which basically means sure if you have enough money to buy groceries until the next paycheck kicks in. In Maryland, that number is 9.5%, and here in Virginia, it is 7.9%. It's a lot of people. Those folks who are food insecure, who just don't know what happens next, they aren't somewhere out there starving in the African desert in the war-torn countries of Eastern Europe. They're right here. In fact, some of them are right here today, this morning, because some of them are us. And some of us feel like we're drowning, not under the weight of other people's hunger, but underneath the impending fear and gripping reality of our own. When I was in the hospital, she spoke of literal hunger. She spoke of an absence of food when she needed it. She spoke of what that drove her to do. There are those all around us who are suffering in just such a way. We do what we can, indeed what we must. We offer everything available from our food pantry. We offer it to one another and to other organizations that try to staunch the flow of need in our community. But that woman, you'll remember, also had another hunger, a deeper one. Her hunger to be respected, to be a respectable person, to have that same gift available to more people, more of the time, everywhere. And when she died, she knew which hunger was the greater. Just this week, Tina gave some food from our pantry to a man who told her he just couldn't get food out of the dumpster for yet another night this week. So we gave him this or that, some cans of tuna or some beef stew, and we sent him on his way, knowing that such assistance for him is likely to be only a Band-Aid. Knowing that the hurt and the shame of sifting through dumpsters and the tragic difficulty of finding a job and everything else that holds him down might well continue to hurt him more than his hungry belly ever has. And probably last night, as we gathered to celebrate and to enjoy one another's company, probably last night he was sifting through dumpsters within walking distance of this congregation yet again. Probably tomorrow morning he'll get up and he'll go to labor finders wishing that the building boom in Prince William County was still going strong so we could lay some brick or roof a house. Probably that little bit of food didn't really fix much. But it was something. It was the something we could do that day to fill not only his belly, but our great need to be of use. We must do what we can when we can. It's important that we make every effort right here at Brew to offer our services within our ability, budget, and boundaries, and that we team up with other congregations and social service agencies to make up some of the difference that we can't meet ourselves. Nobody can do this alone. We can't, Capillary Food Bank can't, not even the whole combined efforts of the entire emergency food systems of this whole world can. And part of that is because the hunger that is met by emergency assistance isn't really the most essential hunger at all. Mark Winney is an advocate for addressing the root causes of hunger. And he says of the global food assistance system that it's kind of like a ship. It just keeps on taking water. It's really hard to steer a new course when all hands on deck are just trying to plug the leaks. And we have never, not once, been able to steer a new course in addressing the underlying causes of hunger. The underlying causes. The root of the problem. The issue behind the issue that until it's addressed will never get out of the way long enough for us to finally get our heads above water and try to swim. What are the underlying causes of the deepest hungers of all? Some years back, when I was living in Chicago, I used to lament profusely the number of deaths by gunshot wounds in my chosen city. I would bemoan the sorry state of affairs, and I would get myself all worked up asking, why? And my dad, being a practical man, used to say to me, why are people getting shot? It's the guns, stupid. Right. The gun, stupid. I was looking for great big metaphorical answers, like the alienation of youth and the sense of desperation in inner city life. And my dad drew me right back to the basics. It's the gun, stupid. It's not just that, but one can't ignore that either. Why are people hungry right here in Manassas? Why are 923 million people all over this world hungry today? Why can't our food pantry feed every single person who comes through our doors and know that they will never need to come back? Why did that woman have to steal food from a dog in order to survive? It's the poverty, stupid. It's the poverty. It's the poverty caused by war and unemployment and irresponsible governmental management and the fact that most of us are running around the deck of the ship just trying to plug the leak. It's not a lack of food. If we had the infrastructure to move food effectively from where it's grown to where it's needed, if poor families in Prince William County could afford fresh vegetables instead of nutrient-poor foods from dehydrated boxes or McDonald's drive-through windows, the undernourished and paradoxically overweight children of this country could live longer. Why? It's the poverty. And though we will do what we can do, and we will do what we must do, until the people with power to change that system, including us, actually find a way to chart a new course, we can expect that every can of tuna we hand out will be met by the need for another. If I were a politician, this is where I would launch into a good policy talk about the way to chart that course, but I am not. I raise questions. And I offer them to you to answer, along with me, as we seek out ways not only to meet the immediate hunger of those with empty bellies, but our hunger to be of use in this world. Even those of us who are blessed enough to be quite secure in our food needs, even abundantly wealthy by any standard except that of the absurdly and obscenely rich, even we are hungry. We're hungry for a way to make a difference. We're hungry for responses from our leaders, from one another, and from our government that go beyond lame excuses. We're hungry to begin the real work that that woman on her deathbed hungered to do, as she told the story of a child who felt such shame. Shame that burned a scar upon her soul, and she knew that that story, the story of a woman now grown, was a story of someone whose hurt burned even more deeply than her hunger ever did. She knew it wasn't over yet, and she died knowing that we still hadn't found answers. We are all hungry. We hunger to make a difference. We hunger to beat back hopelessness, both our own and that of others. We hunger to be proud of who we are and how we affect the world. We must do what we can, and what we can do is different for every person. Some of us will give food to the pantry. Some of us will hand it out. Some of us, like Tina, the first face that most people see who come here to our congregation for food, will treat those who come to receive that food with honor and dignity they have seldom known elsewhere. And some can and must look past that whole system and toward the causes of the problem. Some can and must seek deeper answers, knowing always that it's the poverty we fight, not just the hunger. It's the poverty. And some of us, like that woman who once stole food, might not rest until we have brought about some change in a world whose enduring problems and unmet possibilities are all too consistent. Let us do what we can. Let us do what we must. And when we reach our own culmination, let us know that though we might not have changed at all, we changed enough for one brief lifetime. May it be so. And amen.